Coming up on Broadway Videos this week on Broadway, we talk with Benj Pasek and Justin Paul. We also review Orphans, Jekyll and Hyde, and Macbeth. So please stay tuned. Welcome to Broadway Videos this week on Broadway for Sunday, April 28th, 2013. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this afternoon, we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantiere. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books, the most recent being Broadway MVPs 1960 to 2010, the most valuable players of the past 50 seasons. His columns appear regularly at MTI, Critcherland, Masterworks Broadway, and many other places. Good morning, Peter.
Hi.
Hi. Also with us is Michael Portantiere. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talkin' Broadway, the Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He is also a photographer whose work can be seen at Follow Spot Photo and many other places on the internet, including Talkin' Broadway, where you had a great photo essay on the Easter bonnet for Broadway Cares. Right, Michael?
Oh, thank you very much. Yes.
We'll have to link to that in the show notes. With us this morning, we have not one but two special guests, Benj Pasek and Justin Paul. Are joining us. We know Benj and Justin from a team that wrote A Christmas Story, but Dogfight. And they have a bunch of things coming up, including the release of the album from Dogfight. And so good morning. So just so our listeners understand who is who, Benj, say hello.
Hello.
All right. Good, doing good. And Justin?
Hey there.
All right, so everybody understands who's talking. Thanks so much for getting up on a Sunday morning and joining us. You guys have a lot of things on your plate, including the upcoming release on May 15th of Dogfight, the album from the Off-Broadway show. So why don't you tell us about that?
We're pretty excited. We had a great time doing Dogfight, and we were really fortunate to have a recording that was made with Shikaboom Ghostlight, and we're going to have, it's going to be released, I guess, on Tuesday, April 30th, and we're doing a big Dogfight release CD party at Joe's Pub on the 15th, and the album is going to be in stores on the 21st, so it's really exciting.
How did this project start?
You know, the project started a number of years ago, actually. As maybe some other projects do as well, it started with a different project. It started with Benj and I had moved to the city only recently from college, and we were sort of trying to figure out what our next big project was going to be. And we thought, well, it has to be something that's going to pay our rent because we don't know how to pay our rent. So we thought, well, we know what we can do. This will be easy and straightforward. We'll write the next big teen movie musical. We'll write the next high school musical. That's what we'll do. And we said, oh, this is a fantastic idea. Wow, incredible. And so we
just,
said, okay,
just,
great. We'll write
just integrity right away, you know.
This is what we thought at 22. We said, well, we want to write musicals, but we have to, you know, support ourselves somehow, and we wanted to try to do that writing as well. So we said, well, then we'll just write this, you know, we'll write a really popular movie, which is a horrible goal and unachievable, certainly by us. So, but we set about to do this, and so we said, someone's got to write the screenplay, though. We'll write the songs, but someone has to write the screenplay. And, you know, well, what we said, we went through our Rolodex and we said, who do we know that writes movies? And, you know, the answer was no one. We don't know anyone that writes movies. But I said, oh, I have a friend from high school who I think studied screenwriting in college.
Sign him up.
Sign him up. Great. Done. So that sounds like a great idea. He should write the screenplay. We'll write the songs. It's going to be great. So we contacted him and we said, hey, we have this brilliant idea for a teen movie musical. And he said, okay, sure, let's meet and let's talk about it. And it was a horrible idea. It was about a band, a high school band that becomes famous. Stop me if you've heard this before. It's about a high school band that becomes famous, and then the lead singer and the main instrumentalist get together, and then one becomes more famous, and they break up. It's very, very emotional, you know, high stakes drama. He started working on that movie with us and clearly saw that it was a terrible idea. Didn't say that, but he kept coming to us with different ideas in our meeting.
Every week he would like come to us and he'd be like, okay guys, like this, you know, this movie is like fine, but like, why don't we write a musical that's like, and then he would list things that were totally beyond our comprehension. He'd be like, let's do like Chekhov plays, but set them in the Hamptons and like make them. And we were like, okay, like that's really, you're too smart for us. Like we can't even process this. And he'd be like, you know, he would just name like these things that we were just like, we can't. And he would come back every week with these different sort of pitches and these different ideas. And one week he came back and he was like, guys, this movie's really great that we're working on. It's really great. Like High School Musical 85. Great. But what do you think about like if we made this like movie that I saw, Dogfight, into a musical? And we looked at the CD or the DVD cover, and on it, it basically gave a quick description of the musical. And even before we had watched the movie, we were like, yes, let's do this. Just because the setup felt so right for us to create a musical from the quick description. And it was something that we just sort of knew right away that we wanted to do.
It's often said that writers are loath to repeat themselves, and of course this project bears no relationship whatsoever to Christmas Story. Was that part of the appeal?
You know, we began this project before Christmas Story. So we started actually writing this, or sort of getting in a room all together, in 2008, I want to say, is when we first started working on it. And Christmas Story, we didn't even hear about until 2010. So it's funny that, you know, we definitely didn't plan it that way, but it's really, really, it was a really, really nice thing to have happen that we were able to have, you know, two very different kinds of shows to get to work on simultaneously.
And I think that was part of the appeal when Christmas Story came around. I mean, we were just excited to get the opportunity to write it no matter what, but it was particularly appealing because we thought from the get-go, we wanted to be sure that we were stretching ourselves musically and lyrically and in the worlds that we write in. I think many of the writers that we admire are writers that that have sort of a sound that they've developed on their own, but they're really able to adapt it to different eras and different geographic locations and settings. So I think that's something that appealed to us greatly, was the chance to write in a couple different worlds off the bat, to really stretch ourselves and try to establish being able to do that.
You were also dealing with very different collaborators, because your Dogfight collaborator sounds like a young man, while Joe Robinette, who wrote the book to Christmas Story, is not a young man.
Right. Yeah, no, it was really, I think it's something that we really, really valued about those two projects. And they really, in many ways, couldn't have been more different. And that was such a great experience for us as writing our first two musicals. You know, Joe Robinette has an amount of experience that's like almost unparalleled in terms of what all that he's done and the different kinds of projects that he's done. And he also came into the project with more knowledge than we did. So that was fun to sort of catch up with him and learn from him. And Peter, our book writer for Dogfight, he and I went to elementary school together. So we had sort of a shared history, and, you know, he was also a young guy. So the three of us were all sort of coming up together, figuring it out, and got to work with Joe Mantello as the director, who really sort of shepherded us and wrangled, I should say, the three of us.
Oh, yeah. Before we started recording, Benj made an allusion to Tell Me on a Sunday, which may very well be a show that's older than you guys. How did the interest in musicals that seems to stretch back some time, because you do, when you have to, write in the grand musical theater tradition, how did the interest start for shows of yore? Were you taken as a young kid? What?
You know, I think that something that's sort of interesting, you see musical theater having this big resurgence right now. And I think part of the reason in our generation, I mean, you look at like Glee and Smash and High School Musical and this sort of acceptance of the world of musicals. I think one of the big reasons is because our generation grew up with musicals all the time and we didn't really realize it, which were the Disney movies. I mean, those, you know, Ashman and Menken thing, movies that were coming out when we were, you know, little kids.
Mm-hmm.
I think that influenced a lot of us in a big way. So, you know, when we were 5 years old, 6 years old, these movie musicals were coming out, and that was sort of some of the first entertainment that a lot of the, you know, kids in our generation were exposed to. So I think the idea of being introduced to musical theater at an early age probably made a pretty big difference and was sort of like the gateway drug to then all the other sort of more traditional forms of musical theater, at least for me.
Do you have a theory, you guys, as to why there was that really huge gap for years and years, kind of before Chicago, the film, when nobody was making live action film musicals, and how, you know, now fortunately they seem to be back. Do you have a theory?
I don't know that I do have a theory. I honestly don't. I mean, I wonder. I'm trying to think about what was sort of the last of those before there was that gap, and I don't know if there was a noticeable difference in quality, or if it was just that we're sort of in these cycles, and it seems like we're back into the cycle now. But I agree that it does sort of feel like we're back into the time where it's cool and it's totally acceptable. But like, I know I was just speaking with someone about Smash. And the fact that, you know, the viewership has really fallen off of that show, and this is a person who works in television, and they feel sort of like the era of the musical TV show is like this next cycle of them is sort of coming to an end, and you won't see another one for a number of years. So I don't know if maybe it's just a cycle thing or what it is. Maybe it is. Maybe we just go through these cycles where musicals are exciting and cool. And I mean, I hope that's not the case. but I don't have another theory. I don't know if anyone else does.
Well, I don't know. I guess maybe it has something to do with how quote unquote realistic they are.
Yeah.
Little Shop of Horrors was a very successful, yeah, musical, but you know, not exactly realistic.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know. Les Mis is its own phenomenon, I guess. It's kind of hard to put that into a box.
Right.
But you guys also seem to know popular music as well. I mean, for example, Ralphie to the Rescue, which I'm sure I've played 200 to 300 times in my CD player, often, at dozens of a time in a row, really harkens back to the Vaughn Monroe Ghost Riders in the Sky.
Yeah.
How do you know these songs that you, as a template, to do something that comes out as well as it does?
I think that... I know, at least for me, you know, I paid for it maybe a little bit dearly at the time in school when I was in 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th grade, and like I wasn't completely up on all the, you know, Notorious B.I.G. and Puff Daddy songs and all this stuff. So at that time, but I remember my dad. I remember whenever people would talk to my dad about because both my brother and I are in musical theater. I remember when people would talk to my dad about it. And if it was okay with them, and if he liked it or was annoying, whatever. I remember him telling people, "Hey, well, I can't complain. When I walk through the halls in my house, I hear Frank Sinatra and musical theater and Broadway songs being played. I'd much rather that than rap and, you know, whatever it was." So I know that from an early age, you know, I was listening to, you know, popular music of the day, but also of earlier eras, and I know now even that we're still that we're writing, we're sort of on a constant quest to just digest as much musical material as we can in all genres. So I know, like, for, you know, your specific example of Ralphie to the Rescue, I think Ghost Riders in the Sky, which was sort of was the template for that, was sort of back there somewhere. But even when there's something that we don't have a template for, we're sort of always on the hunt to find something that feels like it's in the world. I don't know.
And I also think that, you know, a lot of it is coming from, you know, even if you don't have, even if you don't know every single song, you know, ever written in the history of songwriting, I think that you can look at, you know, the era that your story is taking place and the characters and, you know, this is like a kid who wants to be a cowboy and all of that. So, you know, I think doing that kind of sort of research in a way, you can access musical styles that might be appropriate for character and for the story that you're actually telling.
We shouldn't neglect to mention that A Christmas Story is coming back to Broadway. That's really so exciting.
Yeah, we heard about that news last week or the week before, and we were very excited about that.
Yeah, we hope that it happens, and that we will be very excited to see it come back to Broadway if it all pans out. Yeah, that's sort of a dream of ours that came true last year. And if it could be a recurring dream, that would be pretty awesome.
I see no reason why it can't play year round. Frankly, has anybody ever discussed the possibility of that?
Yeah, it's been a lot of people discuss it. It's funny, like so many people that we talk to say that exact thing. They say, well, you know, I think it could run during the whole year. But I guess the people with all the money and the power and the decision power to say, yes, we think so too. I don't know. I know it's been talked about even among the team, though. So I think it's a risk that nobody's really willing to take, but everyone thinks we could or should or want to. It's just sort of a thing. I know that there's been theaters available, so I think it's definitely that's something that's discussed all the time. I think it's just I don't know if anybody wants to sort of dip their toes in the water on it or not.
I don't know. You know, my wife spent a ton of money at the Christmas tree shops yesterday in April. So, and the Christmas tree shops are open year round.
Yeah, I know. It's true. There's a Christmas town. I remember going to University of Michigan. There's a Christmas town, Frankenmuth, in Michigan that's open. That you know, year round. That giant Christmas warehouse that's open. So it's and you know the show. It's really funny because the show. It sort of feels like. I mean, it is so much about Christmas in a way, but it also, it's like Christmas happens to be the setting because these people's lives in Christmas Story, that family, that's their lives 24/7, 365. It just, this particular tale takes place around Christmas, so maybe the stakes are ratcheted up some. But, you know, it's the story of a typical family in Depression era, you know, middle America. And that doesn't change with the time of the year. But, you know, it's in the title, so it's sort of hard to.
Right. Well, that's what I think was great about turning it into a musical is that it's not about Christmas. It was about a family, and that really helped us, you know, access it as opposed to it just being like we have to write a thing that's about holiday spirit. You know,
right.
I don't know if you guys, either of you, were at the Broadway Cares Easter Bonnet thing, but they had John Bolton and the dogs in it.
Oh,
We heard about this. We weren't there, but we didn't know it was happening until it had happened. Otherwise, we would have been there.
So great.
Those dogs are stars. I'm going to
tell you.
They are stars, and they are trying to give Sandy a run for her money.
Now, you had the opportunity to take a Christmas Story out of town and work it in Hershey, among other places, without too much of a limelight on you guys to be able to keep working it. Do you think with your ability, having opened it on Broadway now and the success of Dogfight and your work on Smash and you guys are becoming more and more a known entity, are you going to be able to work on your next projects in, you know, relatively safe environments or away from the chat boards of various websites?
I don't know. It's something we haven't thought about, but now I'm really paranoid. So thanks for that one.
Excellent. Hey, I hope I'm always in the back of your mind then.
Your voice.
Wow.
No, I think so. I think, well, I mean, who knows? Maybe we have a different perspective, but I don't think people care that much what we're doing. I mean, maybe they do, but I don't, but I do think that one thing we can speak to is the value of doing that, which is very important to us. I think the ability to go out of town and to work on the show, to see it in front of an audience, having had that experience, I don't think we ever don't want that experience again. So, you know, I think that there's certainly enough places to go to not be in the limelight. And, you know, with people going out of town and reviewing shows for New York publications out of town, I don't know. I guess there's nothing to be done about that. But it's not even for us. It's not even as much about that. It's not even about the critics coming to whatever. It's just about seeing it in front of an audience, because there's so much that we know and or don't know really and can't see and can't tell until it's in front of that crowd. And to be honest, whatever critics say, but for us, it's really about the audience. So that we can get anytime we go out of town, anytime we go somewhere, we're going to get that no matter what. We're going to get an audience of paying patrons who are there to, you know, respond to the musical in an authentic way. And that's the thing that tells us the most, you know, critics and reviews notwithstanding. So I think that will always be available, which is great.
Did you always write in a part for that wonderful little kid tap dancer, Luke Spring, who came in the second act and overwhelmed
you know what?
Us all?
That was
not at all.
Yeah, that was new for Broadway. We, you know, that moment has been a real sort of evolution. Like, we did the show in Seattle and then on tour and then in New York. And in Seattle, it was an entirely different number. It was sort of a weird, nightmarish sequence that didn't really. It was still called "You'll Shoot Your Eye Out."
It basically, though, it was basically the opposite of Ralphie to the Rescue. Like all of the characters that he had shot down in Ralphie to the Rescue, then sort of assumed power over him, and it was still and it became a nightmarish sort of thing. And then we had a version of the song that we had done in the Hershey Chicago, the tour that we had done, but. What we realized is that we needed to make it a more of an event, and so we needed a dance number in that moment. And I guess
we had written a song that was really conducive to that, but it wasn't soaring in the way that it should. And we realized we didn't really have a great production like Ralphie to the Rescue, production number like Ralphie to the Rescue in the second act. And also the thing with we tried to be a little too faithful to the movie, which was that she became the Wicked Witch, but people started thinking there were
Wicked references
and all this stuff. It was like, it's not what we're trying to do, but we understand people are thinking that's so ubiquitous.
Like in the reviews, people would be like, and it's so strange that they pay homage to Elphaba in A Christmas Story. We're like, no, that's not what we're doing at all.
Right, we're being faithful to the movie, but we get why it was in people's minds. So we said, before we came to New York, we sat down with John Rando and we sat down with Warren Carlyle and said, okay, are we happy with the song? Yeah, we're happy with the song. Okay, so what we need a concept for this. We need this to be a fantastic production number featuring this this great teacher who was Caroline O'Connor. And so we started brainstorming ideas. We said Ralphie to the Rescue is so great because it's all Ralph's imagination, and he views himself in the Wild West. And so we started to think, what's around that time? What else could be a fun fantasy sequence for the kids?
At first we went to like a, what was it? Like an Annie Oakley kind of like a shootout kind of thing. But then we thought that's too similar to Ralphie to the Rescue. And then we thought, okay, maybe it can be gangsters and, and that could be the scene. And it ended up, working well, and it became sort of like the highlight of Act Two, certainly, and it surprised us all. But we found actually the number was sort of built around the kid in a way, because our associate choreographer James Gray knew of this kid and like had seen him on YouTube, like an Ellen. He was on like the Ellen DeGeneres Show or something, and he was like, "We need this kid in the show." We were like, "Okay." So so we were like, okay, we got to get him. And then they flew him to New York, and he auditioned for Warren Carlyle, and everybody in the room, I mean, just imagine how people reacted to him on stage in the room with just, six of us watching this little kid, dance. We all were blown away, and decided we needed him in the show.
I think last week I was saying, I hope he's not too old to come back.
No. He'll be back.
So tell young folks who are want to be writers for Broadway musicals and Broadway plays, you started to develop a Christmas Story. what's the genesis of it? How did you first think about this? How did you think about obtaining the rights, and how did this all happen? When did you bring on John Rando? When did you bring on Warren Carlyle? How did this all happen?
You know, Christmas Story is a sort of weird example because it's not something that we actually initiated. I mean, with our show that we did in college, it was very much, our idea, and we're like, we're going to write a song cycle. We're going to, send this song cycle to anyone who will listen. We're going to do our own tour of it. We're going to get it out there. Christmas Story, we were really lucky that we had heard that they were looking for writers for the show, and we decided that we wanted to audition for it. And, just like an actor auditions for, a show, all the writers kind of get together and they write songs on spec. And we were lucky that they chose our songs. But it was more sort of producer driven than writer driven. But once we ended up getting the job and we put up the first production in Seattle, after that, then John Rando came on board and Warren Carlyle came on board for the next season. And then we had our creative team in place.
I'm sorry, did you guys cover this before? I don't recall if you said when you two met.
We met at the University of Michigan, actually, during the summer orientation of our freshman year. And we were both musical theater majors studying to be on the stage and to tap dance and to belt Stephen Schwartz songs and, do what musical theater students do. And sometime around our sophomore year, we had gotten cast as like the worst roles that you can get cast in the musical City of Angels. I was cast as the man with camera. which, means you walk on stage and take a picture. And Justin was Harlan Yamato, the Asian backup dancer. And he is as Aryan can be.
I am neither Asian nor a dancer.
So we sort of decided that we needed to do our own thing. And we decided to write our own show. And our first instinct to do that was not actually to write the show, but was to book a concert venue in Ann Arbor at the Carytown Concert House. And we decided that if we booked this venue and we invited every single person from our department, then we would have to actually write the show. And that's what we ended up doing. So we booked the space and had like a month to write a song cycle. And it was the same year that Facebook and YouTube were sort of coming out. And so it became this thing that sort of, proliferated online. And it sort of started us writing.
Wait. Are you telling me that if you were cast as Stein and Stone, you wouldn't be writing?
I'm telling you, if we were Stein or Stone, there would be no Christmas Story, Dogfight, or Edges. That is very true.
I just want to point out that even what would be considered the worst student in the University of Michigan musical theater program easily could work on Broadway as a performer. It's a feat within itself to get into University of Michigan's program. So you guys must have some talent. I think that you might be underplaying your own talent there, but we're very happy that you guys have found this path.
Yeah, we're happy. I think we just we tricked them. We did something in our auditions made them. We probably, we had like some trick up our sleeve that made them think.
But I'll tell you, we also definitely bonded because we had to take ballet class together, and we were the two just hiding behind each other during freshman ballet, trying not to get noticed.
Yeah, whenever the across the floor sequence would happen, go one at a time across the floor, we would like hide behind each other, or we'd like run out one set of doors and run around and try and come in the other set, so you seemed like we were on the opposite side, but we hadn't actually gone. It was bad.
Excellent. So tell me, at what point in your life did each one of you hear your first Sondheim show?
Let me think. So I think, the biggest impression, believe it or not, I saw Putting It Together two times. I don't know why, because I wasn't coming into the city all the time that much at that time. But for some reason, I came back twice to see that show,
Which production?
It was the one with like Ruthie Henschel and
Carol Burnett.
What's that? Yeah, the Carol Burnett one, exactly. So what year was that?
90-something.
I was probably in middle school or high school then. So that wasn't the first time I heard my first Sondheim song. I'm trying to think when would I have heard my first... You know, the sad thing is for us...
What was the moment?
The sad thing for us is it was probably Dick Tracy, because that was when we were still kids.
Yeah.
We probably didn't even realize that we were hearing Sondheim songs. I will say that my high school in Connecticut, for whatever reason, did like, 100 Sondheim musicals when I was in high school. And it wasn't the first time I heard those songs, but it was the first time anybody had talked to me about those songs. And we were doing Into the Woods. And I think the special thing about this is when I started to think about being a writer, really. I mean, I wasn't conscious of it, but I remember I was playing the Baker in Into the Woods, and we were sitting in rehearsal, and we were talking through the lyrics of No One Is Alone. And we got to the part where people make mistakes, fathers, mothers, and the director stopped us, and he said, okay, so Justin, you're playing the Baker, you just said fathers, and Cinderella just said mothers. Okay, why did you say fathers? And I was like, well, that's what's in the script. I don't know. That's what Chip Zion sings in the cast recording. That's what I'm copying. What do you mean? What do you mean? Why did I say mothers? No. Why did the bakers say fathers? Think about it. Cinderella, why did you say mothers? People make mistakes. Fathers, mothers. And it was the first time, I know that sounds, very juvenile or sounds very, so extremely simple right now, but it was the first time I started to think, okay, wait, there was some guy who decided that this character should say that word because it has a special subtextual meaning. And even though he's not saying what that meaning is, we get it because it's that character. So somebody decided to have that character say those words, not just that it was on the script and not just because Chip Zion sang it in the cast recording. So suddenly I started to think, oh, wow, so somebody's engineering this whole thing. That's really interesting to me. And so, I think that was the first time I started to think about what a writer does and what a musical theater dramatic writer like Stephen Sondheim does. And it sounds very corny and simple now, but I know at the time it was a huge revelation for me.
Bench, what about you?
Well, mine is not as deep as Justin's, but I remember in, I think maybe seventh grade, my choir teacher, Mr. Davis, he had us in class do a weekend in the country. And I remember...
And we were just like, what is this?
And I was like, what is happening?
You're like, this is not the same as Bridge Over Troubled Water.
No, it's not. But I remember too, I mean, similar too, to Justin, the lyric, so inactive that one has to lie down. I was like, what do you mean? Like, what if they're inactive, then why are they tired? Like, I didn't get it. And then he explained to me sort of like why that was a clever lyric. And I was like, oh my God, this is so clever. And then I was really into it. And then, we sort of studied that show that year in my chorus class, which was pretty cool when you think about it. So I think that, Justin and I were both, we both benefited from having, really great music teachers who exposed us to sort of more challenging work than most kids get.
The reason that I ask this is because I've so many comparisons to the two of you to the young composers in Merrily. And I wonder if you have any feelings about Merrily or any comparisons that you would follow those roles there.
I will say,
I hope there aren't too many.
No, exactly. Yeah,
you're scaring the crap out of me right now.
Keep me in the back of your mind whenever you.
I know. Yeah, really. Everywhere you go. Well, I'll first say that I do live in apartment 5H, so that's kind of weird. So that's just one thing I think about. But actually, Merrily is a favorite show of ours. And Justin was in Merrily. We were along in high school. And when I went to go to see University of Michigan, when I auditioned there, the show that they were doing that they were putting up was Mary Lou Roll Along, and I got to see one of the run-throughs of it, and it was the first time that I had heard of the show, let alone seen it, and it knocked me out, and so I credit Mary Lou Roll Along to, like, the reason that I knew I had to go to the University of Michigan, you know, more than anywhere else in the world, because it was such a profound, like, moment for me. So I love the show, and I hope that we don't end up like Charlie and Frank.
No.
but I think we have a lot of love and respect, and the score is amazing. And yeah, I saw the City Center production 3 times, so we like it a lot.
Well, we wish you that you will be rich and happy at least throughout your entire lives.
Oh, thank you.
You've brought us a great deal of pleasure. You've made us very happy, and you've certainly enriched our lives already.
Oh, thank you. That's very nice.
So, well, we'll get it back to the current day and talk that you have the Joe's Pub appearance coming up at May 15th.
Yeah, we're really excited. We're going to sort of be celebrating the release of the Dogfight album. And so we've got pretty much most of the cast from the second stage production last summer is going to be joining us. We're going to have the band from the second stage production. It's going to
and
be sort of a...
we have a really, really good surprise that we can't tell, but we just want to entice any listener that we have a really, really good special guest who's going to come and perform a Dogfight song that we're very excited about.
Wow. Hasselhoff.
It's better.
It might even be better. It's pretty good.
Well, Josh Segarra goes to my gym, and I know he's very excited about it.
Well,
what gym do you guys go? I need to join that gym.
Yeah, if Josh Segarra went to my gym, I would just feel bad about myself all the time. Yeah.
Tell me about it.
That's funny. Yeah, no, we're really excited about the concert, and it's going to be a great time to get everyone back together. We're also doing May 23rd. We're going to do a Barnes & Noble event as well to release the album. So there will be a couple songs performed there, and then, as we said, of course, May 15th at 9:30 p.m. at Joe's Pub. And we're also going to be selling copies of the CD at that time. And I'm sure if someone was really nice, they could get Lindsay Mendez to sign it for them if someone cared about that. So, you know.
Which Barnes & Noble?
Is it the Upper East Side one?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
86th Street.
Yeah. That's like the only one left, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
I think there's one more.
Union Square.
Right. Yeah.
You could do the mall in New Jersey.
Yeah, right.
Road trip. Let's do it.
And then you have a talk back for a movie called One Night Stand on May 30th at the Quad Cinemas. Tell us about that.
It's April 30th.
April 30th.
Yeah, it's in a couple days. We did this thing, the 24-hour musicals, which I know that they're doing now in a couple days or today even. I don't even know.
I think it's tonight.
Yeah, and it's a benefit for... the Orchard Project, and it's basically what they do is they throw in a bunch of writers and composers and actors and directors, and your sort of task is to write a musical overnight and it goes from nothing to being performed in 24 hours. And, you know, I think we were involved maybe the second year that they did it, and we didn't really know that they asked us if they could, like, film some stuff, and we thought that it was just going to be, like, a little thing, and then cut to, like, 2 years later, they've made a full documentary about this process, about, you know, writing these musicals. And, it was a very crazy night. We got to work with Jesse Tyler Ferguson was in our musical, Cheyenne Jackson.
Roger Bart,
Scarlett Strallen. Some great people. And Justin was sick that night, and he threw up in a trash can, and we bicker a lot. And it's like a very funny
night.
Very
dramatic. Very nice.
Dramatic.
I'd be very annoyed at them. You know, you have 24 hours to write and perform a musical, and they got 2 years to make a damn documentary.
I know.
Right. That's what
what's up with that.
I know, exactly. So anyway, you can catch all the drama and all the unnecessary hysterics, et cetera, in this documentary. It's playing, I think it started playing on the 26th, and it's playing through May 2nd, maybe I want to say. But on the 30th, we're going to be there at the screening, and then to do a sort of a Q&A after it. So it's fun. I think people, it's like dramatic for no reason, which is very fun. So I think people should come see it.
So if we went to PasekandPaul.com, would we have a list of these things that are coming up for you guys?
You know what? You will as of tomorrow.
As of Monday.
Yeah.
Yes.
The launch of the new website.
yet.
Oh, that's awesome. And will it have like an e-commerce online store where we could buy a little passing of mold trinkets, like, you know, a bag of vomit or something like that?
Yeah, so we do sell our sheet music. Thanks for asking.
Okay.
Well, I told Benj that I drank my morning coffee today from my Christmas Story sippy cup.
Very nice. So you were drinking during the show. I see. That's why you enjoyed it.
The only way we get through it on.
Yeah, I understand.
Well, Benj and Justin, thank you so much for spending so much extra time with us on a Sunday morning. We really, all three of us have been singing your praises for the last couple of years, and we're so excited you were able to join us and share some of your time with us. Please come back soon.
We'd love to. Thank you so much for having us. It's a true honor and a thrill, so thank you so much.
We had a great time, and thank you guys for being so nice to us and liking our work. It means a lot.
It was so great to have Benj and Justin on with us. We have to catch up a number of shows that have opened. April is always a crazy month on Broadway, and we haven't covered Orphans yet. So let's talk about Orphans, which opened at April 18th at the Schoenfeld. Peter, why don't you start us off with that?
Well, I had not known a production of Orphans. I'd never seen one. So I did have the movie, which I had never watched, but I thought, okay, I like to do my homework. Let me watch the movie. So I did watch the movie, and I didn't much like it. it was very dour, very creepy in the worst sense of the word, because this deals with two brothers, Orphans, obviously, one of whom terrorizes the other. He enjoys being in charge, and that's Treat is his name, and he is certainly dominant, while Philip may be developmentally disabled, or is it a case that his brother has just beaten him down so much? We really don't know. Into their lives comes Harold, a rather wealthy man who starts to dominate their lives, both improving them in a certain sense, certainly economically, but not necessarily in a legal sense, because he does some things that are questionable. And we do get the impression that the money that he's making is not done in the best possible way. All right. So the movie was very dour, and it didn't much hold me, though I did watch the whole thing. I couldn't believe what a difference it made with Dan Sullivan's direction, and to be fair, an audience. Perhaps if I had seen the movie of Orphans in a movie theater with an audience, I would have had a different experience, but Dan Sullivan has really given it a very light touch, and as a result, it's funny. It's perversely funny. It's blackly funny. It's gallows humor, to be sure, but nevertheless, it's really funny. I was tremendously impressed by Tom Sturridge, who really is a bird man in the sense that he jumps around the stage as if he really is an eagle in flight. It's pretty impressive. Ben Foster is the brother, is quite good as well, but there's no question that Philip is the showier part. And and his going, jumping from place to place to place to place is really flabbergasting to see. Alec Baldwin's wonderful as Harold, the guy who takes over their lives. And but what a wonderful experience to have, watching that movie and not being impressed, and then coming and seeing that there is a lot of humor and a lot of truth in Orphans. And I really recommend that people get to see it on Broadway rather than watching that movie from a few years ago.
All right. Michael, what do you think?
Peter, that's interesting. You so did you previously know the piece only through reading the play?
I didn't know it at all.
Oh, okay.
I knew nothing about it.
Oh, okay. I thought you had said a few weeks back that it was a good play. Maybe you were just talking about its reputation.
Oh, well, I was talking about its reputation. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Interesting. Yeah, I had never seen it in any form, and I have to say the movie has quite a cast: Albert Finney, Matthew
sure.
Modine, and Kevin Anderson.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
I'm going to have to check that out. I went into it cold, and it is quite a very interesting and powerful play, and really the you know, one of those great plays that kind of brings you from hysterical laughter, you know, to some different kinds of emotions, you know, fear and just tears, some, you know, in a few moments maybe.
I agree about Tom Sturridge. He reminded me actually of Spider-Man, yes. The way he was jumping around the stage. I wonder if that's in the script.
Yeah, good point. It's not in the movie, by the way.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So maybe that was something that he and Dan Sullivan came up with. And it really was really so impressive. And he did, also to my ears, a flawless American accent. He's British, Tom Sturridge. Which brings me to actually Alec Baldwin. I enjoyed him very much, but I was a little distracted. It seemed to me that his accent kept changing, and I've actually heard other people comment on that. Sometimes he sounded a bit British. Sometimes he sounded New York. Sometimes he sounded Midwest. It's actually supposed to take place. The play is set in North Philadelphia, which apparently has its own very distinct accent. So that was a little distracting to me, but he certainly, anyone who's seen Alec Baldwin on stage knows that he has a tremendous amount of charisma and magnetism, and he really holds a stage. And I thought that Ben Foster did a wonderful job as Treat. I'm sure many of us, our listeners, remember that Ben Foster was a late replacement for Shia LaBeouf, who left the production under controversial circumstances. So I thought he was excellent also, and it's great to see a play like this on Broadway because you know, especially belatedly, it's never been on Broadway before, and it's dates from the early 80s or even earlier. So it's nice to see it, you know, even if it needs requires stars like Baldwin and Sturridge and Foster to bring it to the stage. I'm glad it got here, and I'm really glad I saw it.
Well, it's seemingly doing very good business. It's extended for a little while. I think up until the Tony Award season. We'll see what happens with it after that. But
it's nice that Alec Baldwin keeps coming back to the theater.
Isn't it? Mm.
Yes.
He certainly doesn't need to, except he does. You know, so that's really terrific.
He's such a New Yorker. Mm-hmm. You know, and he spent so much time out on the West Coast during the run of 30 Rock, the television show, which is about New York and Rockefeller Center and NBC and things like that. But it's really great to have him back on Broadway. Also back on Broadway is Jekyll and Hyde at the Marquis Theater. It opened up on April 18th. And Michael, why don't you start us off with Jekyll?
Well, thank you, James.
Well, you know, Mom always said, if you don't have anything nice to say.
Actually, I have some nice things to say. Constantine Maroulis' vocal performance in the show is quite astounding. He has an amazing instrument, a vocal instrument, I will say, and I'm sure his fans would agree. He sings very, very excitingly, and he also seems to do it. It seems to me he does it without damaging his voice. It doesn't sound like it's hurting him. And a lot of contemporary singers don't seem to have figured out that kind of technique. I also thought his acting was quite good as Jekyll and Hyde, including quite a credible British accent. I don't think he's necessarily thought of as an actor of the first rank. So that impressed me. And not just the accent, just the way he inhabited the role. Deborah Cox sounded wonderful as Lucy. She has a very distinct kind of smoky voice, I think you would say. And it's not something you hear that often on Broadway or anywhere else. And I thought that really helped the character. Acting wise, not as successful, but certainly not embarrassing in any way. I mean, she certainly held her own. It was nice to see Richard White back on stage, who most people know as the voice, the singing and speaking voice of Gaston in the film of Beauty and the Beast. But he did a lot of theater work at Paper Mill and also elsewhere. It was nice to see him back. And Teal Wicks, I should mention, as Emma, also is a lovely
young performer with a great voice. But I guess, you know, to me, this is one of the worst shows ever written in terms of, well, two things. In terms of the way that Frank Wildhorn's score just goes back and forth wildly, you know, through different styles, you know, sort of 80s rock ballads, you know, to other numbers that sound like more or less traditional Broadway, and no consistency whatsoever. And it lends the whole thing a very cheesy quality, which is only exacerbated by just laughable lyrics by, I hate to say, by Leslie Bricus, who has done some great work in his career, but not really in this show. I mean, some of the actually the more famous songs, the lyrics are kind of generic, but they're not embarrassing. This Is the Moment and Someone Like You. Those are all fine, you know, as pop songs. But the sung dialogue and some of the other sections, it's just, you can't quite believe that somebody actually wrote this and that it actually has been produced on Broadway and in many other places. Just really, really embarrassing work. I hate to say it. So I can't, you know, there's only so much that I'll ever be able to enjoy any production of Jekyll and Hyde. And even though this was quite a good production for what it is, it's still Jekyll and Hyde. So, yeah, I don't know. Apparently this production toured extensively before coming in, and I believe it originally was supposed to be an open-ended run, but then they decided not to because it really did not do that well on tour, and it's easy for me to understand why. It's just a not the kind of show that musical theater writers want to aspire to, let's put it that way.
Peter, what did you think?
Well, I go back a long way with Jekyll and Hyde. I went to a workshop in 1992 when Terrence Mann was playing the parts. And I did go to Houston in 1996 to see the kickoff of the national tour that Gregory Boyd directed. Vivian Madelon, by the way, directed that 92 workshop. And then Robin Phillips came in 1997, just before they opened on Broadway. And so I've seen this show 10 times now, wow. Mostly because I was assigned feature stories on it, believe me. And I have to say that Jeff Calhoun's current production is easily the best of the four. It has far more excitement. It's far more slick. I felt like I was in the theater a very short period of time. I was amazed at how quickly events were unfolding. Also, I like the fact that this is a more elaborate production. It doesn't use the tired unit set idea that so many modern paupers have used. I'm not saying the set is elaborate. It is not. However, it's great to see different locales represented a little more realistically than was seen on the unit set. So, yes, Constantine Maroulis sings wonderfully well. He tries very hard. He really wants to be good. There's no question about it. I was amused when he started singing This Is the Moment because he sang this. And then he waited so long, you know, before saying Is the Moment. It really was a case where he was saying, here it is. Here's the hit song. This is the one you've been waiting for. So, however, good as he is and hard as he tries, good Lord, he has zero sex appeal and no charisma whatsoever as Henry. I mean, he's the type of – he looks like he would give your high school audiovisual club a bad name. You know, he must have had multiple callbacks for Revenge of the Nerds. I mean, he really is somebody who just is – when you've seen Bob Cuccioli do the part – who really did have enormous sex appeal and tremendous charisma, it's very hard to take Constantine Maroulis in this role. He just doesn't have that, and you have no idea why Emma is so attracted to him. And Teal Wicks really does a very good job of acting as if she's deeply in love with this man. So she does that very skillfully, so that's good too.
Peter, I would completely agree on that specific point, but it would seem that many people disagree. You know, I mean, yeah, just for the record,
some people like their meat rare and some like it well done. So, I mean, you know, who can say? I mean, yes, I imagine there is a contingency out there that finds him has tremendous sex appeal and wonderful charisma. I didn't see it at all. And I think that's a problem for the production. And I'm sorry that he's doing it, because I think the show could be better with somebody along the lines of Bob Cuccioli, who I really felt should have won the Tony that year. James Naughton won that year for Billy Flynn, which is a far less demanding role. And and I don't think James Naughton did it nearly as well as Jerry Orbach did, who didn't get a Tony for it. So, but I do think Cuccioli should have won. Funny thing, the big joke of Jekyll and Hyde has often been Cuccioli's confrontation number, where he swung his hair back and forth, making it look neat when he was Jekyll and not so neat when he was Hyde. That doesn't happen in this production. They now have him confronting a movie. And may I point out that that was the original way they were doing it in Houston back in 1996.
Jekyll, oh, really?
Movie. So they've returned to that idea, perhaps because it became the standard go-to joke for the show of the swinging the hair back and forth. So so it will never be my favorite show. I agree with Michael that indeed the score, the songs don't sound as if we're in the late 19th century. And it doesn't do very much for me. I'm never emotionally involved with this guy. One of the things that was added along the way was something that's still there. At the beginning of the show, we find out that one of the reasons he wants to do this, to rid evil from man, is because his father is genuinely insane to the point where he's strapped down. This is far more dramatic, by the way, in this production. You just saw a body on a gurney in the Robin Phillips production. Here you see a guy who's, you know, really stage center and is, you know, you can tell in pain and torment. I liked it better when he just wanted to do it for mankind. It wasn't that he needed to do it for his father. That he wanted to do it for mankind was a stronger and better issue. So I felt bad about that. Fans of all these albums of Jekyll and Hyde, God knows Jekyll and Hyde has fans, might be pleased to know the two songs that have been dropped along the way are back in, and that's I Need to Know, the first song that Jekyll sang in Houston and was gone by the time they got to New York, and Bring on the Men, which is Deborah Cox's song, Lucy's song, the prostitute's song. it's more up-tempo than the one that replaced it, Good and Evil, which Robin Phillips wanted in instead. So I've heard from a few Jekkies on the show, and from the way they were saying to me along the way, it's different. It's really, really different. I got the impression they didn't like it as much. That may be because, God knows, they had seen it hundreds of times at the what was then the Plymouth Theater. So it may very well be that they just got used to what that was. But I find this a far superior production.
All right. So what's the how long is this playing for at the Marriott Marquis?
This 18 weeks, 14 weeks, something like that.
Yeah. So it should be through the summer.
Well, be seeing this. You know, I mean, the reviews were lethal. They always have been for this
lethal.
Show. And, you know, I don't know what their advance is like. I wouldn't be surprised, given those reviews, if they close early. And yet, you know, I mean, the original ran 4 years. And, so there's obviously an audience for this show or this title. Perhaps it's that. But
It'll be interesting to see. There, that's all very true. But on the other hand, it has been touring. So maybe a lot of those fans got to see it elsewhere. And of course, not all of them are going to be, you know, necessarily come to New York to see it, the ones who don't live here.
Yeah, the although summer is pretty good to Broadway and a lot of European tourists and things like that. And Constantine's got his own fan base with Idol. So it'd be interesting to see if they're able to hold this.
It's supposed to close on June 30th, the same day that Orphans is closing. We'll see if that turns out to be true.
Mm. All right. So talking about another limited run, on April 21st, Macbeth opened at the Barrymore, starring Alan Cumming. So Peter, why don't you start us off with Macbeth?
Well, I didn't like it much. The concept is that a man is in a mental institution, and a male and female nurse look in on him from time to time. And I don't know if he's passing the time or what he's doing, but he does recite Macbeth for us and plays the different characters. And I wasn't interested, really. I won't say that Alan Cumming is doing a bad job. No, he's not. He's certainly doing what he set out to do. But this is not the way I want to see Macbeth, frankly. It just didn't hold me. I found my attention wandering and wishing that I could see a real production of Macbeth. So I have nothing more to say. I just didn't much like it.
Yeah, I agree completely. I think it had its moments when it clicked into the story, and there were certainly moments when you were moved and brought into it, I felt. But for the most part, I thought of it more as a really impressive stunt that did not really move me. And also, aside from all that, I mean, I happen to know, I think Macbeth is the Shakespeare play I know best. First of all, because it's his shortest play. And secondly, I was in a production, so I know it really, really well. But even I had some moments where it was very difficult for me to realize who was talking, because he goes back and forth between the various characters, and he does some very interesting things in trying to delineate who's who. Like at one point in the beginning, he was I guess when he was being Macduff, he had an apple in his hand that he was tossing. And then when he switched to Macbeth, he would stop tossing the apple. So things like that helped a little bit, but still there were moments where it really was very confusing. And why have that, also, Peter, isn't this mental institution thing, isn't that becoming its own cliche? The John Joyle production.
Yeah,
of course, that wasn't a one-person production.
Yes, it was set in one of those facilities, no question about it. I think Comedy of Errors may very well be Shakespeare's shortest play, but it did occur to me, Michael, I have to admit, while I was watching it, say, if you really wanted to show off, Alan, you wouldn't pick one of the shorter plays. You would you'd take on Hamlet. But I wouldn't want to see that either. This is something I went to with great curiosity and great enthusiasm, and it didn't take long for my enthusiasm to dampen. So I'm amazed that it got on, and I'll be amazed if this turns out to be a popular hit.
Yeah, I think it probably was. I mean, some people have used the word vanity project, and I don't think that's completely unfair. He did it at the Lincoln Center Festival.
Yeah.
It was a production of the National Theatre of Scotland, and it still is that same production. And as I said, there were many creative things in it. I like the way it began and ended. The same way, although I've seen that done actually in previous productions of Macbeth. And there was some interesting use of video in this production as well. Live video. I mean, Cumming being picked up on stage by cameras and us seeing and hearing him on monitors up at the top of the stage. So there were definitely interesting things in it. And for the record, there are two. I think it, there were three other people listed, but it wasn't it only two actors and maybe one is the understudy?
Yeah.
Yeah. Jenny Sterling and Brendan Titley as doctors or and or orderlies in this mental institution. But they are there mostly to facilitate and there's one scene where they have a fair amount of dialogue, but other than that, it's really all Alan Cumming all the time, and it's interesting. It's interesting, but not involving, I would say.
So this is playing through July 14th, and tangent to this Macbeth production was, I'm not sure if it was a rumor, if it was or if it was confirmed that Alan Cumming is coming back to Broadway in Cabaret.
Yeah,
have you guys heard this?
Yeah,
with Anne Hathaway.
Anne
Hathaway is.
Yeah.
Well, no. Yeah, well, that was reported, and then and the internet was ablaze with all of that. And then, for the record, Anne Hathaway's people said that it's not true. So. Maybe it is true and they just don't want to tell us yet, or maybe it's not true.
So I thought that we couldn't, we just have to mention that and see how it plays out. And I don't think any of the three of us have any inside information on that.
Well,
no.
I have a funny, another funny Joe Masteroff story. I keep running into him and funny things keep happening. Joe Masteroff is the great author of the book for the original Cabaret, as well as She Loves Me and some other wonderful things. And I saw him actually at Macbeth outside beforehand. And I said, so Cabaret's coming back. And he said, yeah. And I said, oh, it must be so wonderful, you know, for you, aside from everything else, to, you know, to get that income without doing anything. And he said, now, wait a minute. And I said, and I hastened to add, well, I mean, not doing anything, you know, lately, if, as far as that. I mean, having written something incredibly wonderful 55 years ago, and it still keeps coming back. And he said, well, you know, in show business, those things, show business is so unpredictable that when those things happen, you just really have to take them as a gift.
Yeah, it is something how Cabaret has kept becoming a gusher for him, which he might not have expected back in 66, because that was really a very ambitious show for its time. It really is the missing link between the traditional Broadway musical and the concept musical. And as somebody who was with Cabaret from day one and even invested money in it when it was called Welcome to Berlin, I can tell you it was a very daring show for its time. And I don't think that he really would have expected that it would have turned out to be as astonishingly lucrative as it has for him.
And really worth noting that both Cabaret and Chicago – both with scores by Kander and Ebb are really examples of shows that, in a sense, were ahead of their time, as you point out, Peter, and therefore they really have legs, you know.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. James mentioned at the top of the show my book about MVPs of Broadway musicals. I have a new one coming out about Tony Losers. It comes out on March 28th. And I end the book.
May 28th.
Sorry, May 28th. I end the book talking about Chicago, because that was the ultimate Tony Loser at that time. No show had ever lost 9 out of 9 nominations. And look what happened. So my point is, who knows how many of these other Tony Losers in this book might very well turn out to have a renaissance like Cabaret. And I'm sorry, Chicago. Maybe that'll happen. And wouldn't that be wonderful?
That would be wonderful. And not only that, but I can hope that the Scottsboro Boys and The Visit, both of which shows, unfortunately, I hate to say this, but were really kind of torpedoed by someone who writes for the New York Times.
Uh-huh.
I hope that they will be done again and appreciated the next time around, because I think both of them, and both also by Kander and Ebb, it's incredible, have so much to offer to audiences.
So Peter mentioning Chicago is a perfect segue into Michael. You got a chance to see Chicago with Christine Petty and Adam Pascal, who have stepped into the roles of the long-running Broadway production. So why don't you tell us quickly about them?
Yes, I'm glad, very glad that I went back, and I'm happy to report that the show, I thought, was in excellent shape. You know, with something that's been running that long, it can be kind of dicey. But no, I will say that the energy level seemed a little low, but I saw it at a matinee that was not that well populated, so maybe I can attribute it to that. But other than that, I mean, everything was sharp, and the ensemble was really, really sharp. Amy Spanger was terrific. It is giving a terrific performance. Actually, I think she may have just left, and I only saw it about a week or two ago. It must be so difficult at Chicago, you know, just for everyone, the way the Weissers keep rotating people in and out for like 3 or 4 weeks at a time. In a way, maybe it keeps the show, you know, maybe that helps keep it sharp. Mm-hmm. Isn't that interesting? Christine Petty's giving a terrific performance as Mama Morton. I think maybe the first non-African-American woman to do it since Marsha Lewis did it originally, or maybe there have been others, but it seems to have been recast along those lines, largely because of the film, I think. With Queen Latifah. But anyway, she's terrific in it. And Anna Pascal, really, really fantastic as Billy Flynn. I think his acting has improved greatly since he was basically plucked off, not off the street, but wasn't he really just a band singer, a rock singer when he was found for Rent? Really, really impressive, and the show is in really great shape. So I would say that a return visit to Chicago would be well worth your while.
So also, you got a chance to see the New York City Opera at City Center. Tell us about that.
Oh yeah, I wanted to see the City Opera at City Center because, as the press has pointed out a lot recently, that was the company's original home. I think they started there in the 40s, 1944, I think sounds right. And they performed there for decades, two decades, I guess, until they moved to Lincoln Center to the what was then the New York State Theater. And then they left that about 2 years ago, mostly because of financial reasons. So now it's a peripatetic company, and they're performing in various venues, Brooklyn Academy of Music. They did something at the theater at John Jay College. But it was great to see them at City Center. They're doing two operas, one of which is La Pericole, which is actually an operetta by Offenbach. And one of the main reasons I wanted to go was to see and hear what the acoustics are like in City Center for an unamplified, you know, operatic production, because I think everything I have ever seen there in my life has been amplified. And I'm delighted to tell you that the acoustics are excellent. Anthony Tomasini actually just today or yesterday wrote an article in the Times saying that he would hope that there's a way that City Opera can go back to be permanently in residence at City Center. And I think it might be workable because their season is much, much curtailed over what it used to be in recent years because of the aforementioned financial difficulties. So they don't do a lot each year, and it might be possible to work them into the schedule there. I think that would be a really fantastic thing because it seems like such a wonderful fit for them. And this La Pericole is a very delightful production, interesting because it's got a lot of spoken dialogue in French, and they deal with that through super titles that are actually projected above the proscenium and also in one or two places on the set. And that seemed to work really well too. It's not little titles on the back of the seat in front of you. They don't have that. But this seemed to work really well. So I'm so
happy to see them back there. And I'm glad that Tomasini wrote that article, and I really hope it comes to pass.
Yeah, especially because I went away to Amsterdam and Paris. I did see, by the way, that famous production of Sunday in the Park with George, speaking of subtitles, supertitles, which was really glorious. I also saw Waiting for Godot in Dutch. Should have gone across the street to the Bulldog Cafe and got a joint before I saw it. Should have done that, but no, I was good. Aspects of Love in Amsterdam, believe it or not, to a third of a house. Nobody was there. And also in Paris, the Full Monty, which the thing that most interested me about that in French, you know the song Man in the Full Monty. I was wondering if they were going to say you know, and what they actually said was Mec. And those who know Irma La Douce know that that's a term that is used for man in that show. And that's the only time I've ever run into the word mech, in Irma La Douce and now in the Full Monty. So I thought that was very interesting, too. It was a El Cheapo production. It was done on a shoestring, but the cast was very good. So I did have a good time while I was away, but it did mean stacking up a lot of shows. But, you know, what are we talking about here? It's a pleasure to go to the theater, and especially when it's good. Most of the things this season have been good. I think it's been a very good season. Not everybody agrees with me. But many of the things I've seen have pleased me immeasurably. So, yeah. I mean, I'm amazed how many critics come up to me and say, I'm exhausted. Why, are you sitting down? I mean, yes, of course. You do have to think, you know, what are we going to say? What are we going to say that nobody else has ever said before? What are we going to say that nobody else is going to say? What are we going to say that we won't be repeating ourselves? Yeah, it's work to that degree. Then we have to write the review, no question about it. But please, my father was a plumber. Now that was work.
Yeah, agreed, Peter. But I guess it's just in an ideal world, everything would not open at exactly the same time, and which results in some things, you know, I think getting lost in the shuffle. I don't know if we mentioned that I was talking with someone who said that they thought in retrospect it would have been better, for example, if Hands on a Hard Body had opened earlier in this season, and then it would have maybe gotten more attention and, you know, just not gotten lost in the shuffle, as I said.
Well, my hat's off to the both of you, because, you know, from my perspective is that, you know, April 18th, Orphans and Jekyll and Hyde opened. So at some point during this whole thing, you both would have had to see Orphans and go and grab your thoughts and get them down on paper or an email or something. And then, you know, you both have extensive writing schedules. So it's you spend 2-3 hours at the theater, then you come back and I assume spend 2-6 hours writing these reviews. And then you're on to your next thing. And it becomes a little bit of a heavy rotation.
Frankly, what I thought you were going to say is because Jekyll and Hyde and Orphans open the same night, I thought you were going to make some sort of allusion that the Jekyll part of us went to one show and the Hyde part of us went to another, which would have been kind of interesting. A thing I wanted to say, by the way, about Jekyll and Hyde, when Michael was talking about how so much of the music sounds so contemporary, I wouldn't mind seeing this show done in a contemporary setting. I think it might help it immeasurably. And of course, given that it's about Henry Jekyll, who's the nice guy, and Mr. Hyde, who's not, I think it should be called Henry Unsweet Henry. That's what I think it should be called. So,
Before we go, I just wanted to say that Peter and Michael, I want to ask you, see if we can get Mark Shaiman on the show, because I have a bone to pick with Mark Shaiman.
Oh.
And I love Mark Shaiman. I love his work and things like that. Michael, did you see this on Facebook this morning? He's got a picture of Mark and Matt Morrison are in London for something, and he's got a picture of it, and he says, "Brunch in London with Television's Matt Morrison."
Oh.
And I was very unhappy about that, and I posted on the picture. I said, "Broadway's Matt Morrison, thank you very much."
We had him first.
And
I imagine he was being ironic.
So anyway, after all the craziness of the awards are off and maybe into the summer, we'll see if we get Mark on, and and chat about his projects and see what's going on. So I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these podcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com, and there's a subscribe button. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. If, in fact, you want to listen to us in another way, you can listen to us through the Stitcher app, which is for your iPhone, your BlackBerry, your Android device, and stream us right directly to it. Or you can listen on Broadway World Radio. Broadway World plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. Our contact information for Peter, Michael, and me are at BroadwayRadio.com, as well as links to some of the things that we've talked about today, as well as a link back to PasekandPaul.com, Benj and Justin's site, where you can see everything that they're doing as well. So on behalf of Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
All disasters have an upside. You can find one if you try. You went dancing, you were dancing. You were dancing with a guy. Isn't it funny? Just cruel. Shut the light off, turn the bed down. No more crying, don't you dare. You'll wake up sometime tomorrow and forget to even care. Isn't it funny? Funny.